Ladies and gentlemen, today I'm with an individual that needs little introduction, the famed author Richard Weiser Happier, a book I highly recommend all of you get, one of the best books I've read this year. Mr. Green, thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure to be here.
Absolutely. You know, Mr. Green, one of the questions I have for you, and I think a good way to begin is, what ultimately inspired you to write this book?
I think I was really trying to synthesize 25 years of studying great investors, interviewing lots of extraordinary investors. And then while I you know, going back a very long way, I'd interviewed people like Jack Bogle, the founder of Vanguard, and I'd interviewed Peter Lynch and Fayez Sarrafim, who was known as the Sphinx, who, you know, I'd visited him in his office in Houston, and he had, you know, an El Greco and a Kandinsky on the wall. So I'd spent a lot of time with these great investors. And over the years, I'd met some that I thought were just absolutely extraordinary. And so partly what I was doing was saying, okay, so what have I learned from these people over 25 years? But if I were to focus on the ones who were most remarkable and most interesting and have thought most deeply, not only about how to get rich, but about how to think better and how to live better, what would I learn from them? And what would help me in my own life? And what then could I share with other people? So in a sense, it was a process of trying to distill and synthesize the most important lessons from the greatest investors. And part of that was really purely selfish. It's trying to figure out, well, how do I make sense of the world? How do I deal with the fact that the future is unknowable and yet I've got to make decisions about the future? How do I apply something like Charlie Munger's idea of reducing standard stupidities, of succeeding by simply avoiding dumb stuff? What has someone like Joe Greenblatt figured out about how to simplify life and how to simplify investing? Then I, you know, I had interviewed people like Arnold Vandenberg, who are absolutely extraordinary, not only as investors, but as human beings. And so I wanted to say, what has someone like Arnold figured out about actually how to live and what constitutes a truly abundant life? So in a way, the whole project, on the surface, it's about how to get rich, but underneath, it's really about how to live. What actually constitutes a successful and abundant life? And the reason I wanted to investigate this is because I'm trying to figure out how to have a successful and truly abundant life.
Wonderful. And in meeting these amazing individuals, was it what you expected or was it a little bit different? Were you a little bit surprised by what you found?
One of the bets that I made, sort of an intellectual bet that I made very early on, was that there's a continuity, a consistency between the way somebody invests their money and thinks about getting rich and being successful in the markets and the way that they operate in other areas of their life. And I didn't really have much evidence for this, but the more I dug into it, the more I would find, once you start looking at someone's personality, you see that the way that they think, for example, about risk, or the way that they deal with their own psychological biases, really pervades everything that they do in their life. And so part of the joy of the book for me was to go in, say, to the life of someone like Howard Marks, for example, and to be able to say, well, actually, this idea that he figured out very early in his life when he went to Wharton and he stumbled into a Japanese studies class, and he studies this Buddhist concept of mujo, which is about impermanence. That idea of impermanence, the fact that everything is changing all of the time, actually ends up being this master principle that runs through every aspect of his life. And so you look at the way that he invests, and it's all built on an understanding that nothing stays the same. And so when you're going through a very bullish period where everyone is getting carried away and everyone's excited and they become complacent, he has this awareness built on an understanding of mujo, of this sense that everything changes. He has this understanding that the pendulum will swing. And likewise, when you're in the depths of COVID and everyone is in a panic and it feels like the world is going to end, everything changes and the pendulum will swing again. And so that ends up running through every area of his life, that awareness of change, that awareness that because everything changes, for example, it's a really dumb thing to assume that you're some kind of master of the universe, because things change and it's not stable. And so you have to be kind of humble, because in a world where everything is changing and the future is unknowable, you have to accommodate yourself to change. You have to accommodate yourself to reality as it is, and then adapt to those conditions. And so if you think about just that one example of Mujo, it affects the way that you invest, but it also affects the way that you live, because you have to say, for example, well, okay, so if it's really icy conditions outside and the weather is terrible, let me drive slower. Mm-hmm. If I'm really flooded by emotion and I'm afraid and my portfolio just went down by 30% and I'm over leveraged, I'm gonna make really terrible decisions. So let me slow everything down. Let me pause. Let me acknowledge my vulnerabilities. Let me acknowledge that everything changes. And so I think that was one of the great surprises, in a way, was the consistency of certain principles in people's lives.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. I think that's definitely true. Like, if you meet a lot of these wonderful investors, like for instance, we had the famed value investor, Mr. Guy Spier, who I know is a very good friend of yours, on the show last month. You see that they all have something in common. They seem to be very intellectual people. They're not only interested in investing, but they're very worldly thinkers. When we were speaking with him, we were speaking about everything from investing, business, politics, technology. He's just like a wealth of information. And then just to touch on the other point you mentioned, it seems like they don't only focus on the upside, but they also focus particularly on the downside.
Particularly, I think, with this school of people that comes through Ben Graham and Buffett, right? Like I remember once, I don't know if you remember Irving Kahn, who died at the age of 109, who was actually a teaching partner of Ben Graham's at Columbia. And he had started in the market in 1928 or 1929, right as the crash of 29 was beginning. And so he'd spent more than 80 years in the market. And very shortly before he died, really about 3 or 4 months before he died, he was very sick. And I wrote a bunch of questions that his grandson, who is also an analyst in the investment business, took to him. And over several days, he asked his grandfather these questions. And this 108, 109-year-old man answered these questions about the secrets of investing and what he'd learned over his long career and what he'd learned from being so close to Ben Graham for much of his life. And the thing that Irving Kahn said is, he said that the most important lesson in investing is to consider the downside. Is it safety first? And he talked about how all of these friends of his who were speculators, who were in a hurry to get rich, they ended up not really doing as well as the people who preserved their capital, who focused on the preservation of capital. And I think that's one of those lessons that we've been rudely reminded of again in the last year or so, when people got really complacent, they got ahead of themselves, and they started to think, even a lot of the best value investors around started to think, well, yeah, I can pay up for the really high quality companies. And this is something I've talked to Guy Spier about a lot recently. I have a new episode with him that just came out on my podcast, the Richer, Wiser, Happier podcast, where we talked about why so many people who are really smart, thoughtful investors got seduced into paying, 100 times revenues to invest in Snowflake, or limitless valuations for, Carvana or whatever it was, really high quality companies like Spotify and Netflix, that where he was talking about their heroic assumptions about the future. And I think in some ways they were forgetting this very basic lesson about the downside. Always consider the downside. Always think first about what you can lose. And when I interviewed Jeffrey Gundlach for my book, who is often called the King of Bonds, who at the time was overseeing something like $140 billion in assets, he said to me, look, I'm wrong about a third of the time. And he said, so I have to ask myself before I ever make any investment, I have to say to myself, what's the consequence if I'm wrong? Mm-hmm. And that's an incredibly powerful insight, that once you recognize your own fallibility, your own blind spots, your own vulnerability to unexpected things that can come out of left field and hurt you, you really have to tread more lightly in life, be a little more humble, be asking yourself, well, if the worst happens, will I survive it? And so I've made plenty of investment mistakes over the years. One of the things that I did a year or so ago is I bought Alibaba after an incredible conversation that I had with Charlie Munger and Lou Simpson and a few other great investors on a Zoom breakfast. And, you know, they'd actually assigned reading my book as their homework for the breakfast. And so here I have like Charlie Munger and Lou Simpson telling me how great my book is. And so I'm feeling like absolutely on top of the world. I mean, it's like a highlight of my life, right? And Lou Simpson is talking about how he just bought Alibaba the day before. And so I'm like, wait, so I have like the greatest value investors of all time buying Alibaba. And it's like, and this is one of the happiest memories of my life. You know, partly for psychological, irrational reasons, I buy it because I'm sort of, I mean, you know, I think it was intellectually defensible, but I'm aligning myself with these giants who love me and make me feel like I'm finally accepted. And you know, so it plays to all sorts of psychological biases. And so, you know, since then, I'm probably down about 55%, 57%, something like that. But even when I look at a mistake like that, it's a non-fatal error. And this is one of the things that Jeffrey Gundlach said to me is he said, make sure that your errors are non-fatal. And so for this, it's a small enough position that it's not going to change whether I send my kids to college or whether I go on vacation. It's like, it's a little embarrassing. It's a little painful. It's a little annoying. It's also not done yet. We'll see what happens over the next few years. But it's a non-fatal error. And I think that's a really important insight that even when you're aligning yourself with Charlie Munger and Lou Simpson, two of the greatest investors of their generation, you can still be woefully wrong. And so just go into things humbly and with an emphasis on survival. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that Howard Marks said to me is he said it's not about eschewing all risk. It's not about avoiding all risk. It's about taking intelligent risk, considered risk. And so again, it's like think of that analogy of driving more safely on a road in icy conditions. So when people are overly complacent and there's too much risk in the market and everyone's operating as if it's always going to be blue skies forever, that's the most dangerous time, right? That like, you know, I'm sort of mixing the analogies because although it's blue skies and everything looks good, actually it's icy conditions, but maybe it's like black ice concealed. And so you just have to go very carefully. And likewise, at times where there's not much complacency, where there's lots of pessimism built into the market, lots of fear, it feels like a very scary time. But in fact, it may be that there's much more opportunity then because of the valuations. And so it's a very difficult game, right? Because so much of it is psychological. So much of it is about trying to tap into this more rational part of ourselves that's not just governed by fight or flight and the terror of disaster in these moments when everything feels like it's falling apart.
Exactly. And I think that's what Charlie Munger had actually told you when you met him in person. He said something that Warren Buffett speaks about all the time, which is you got to stay in the game because the moment you make a really drastic mistake, you're not in the game any longer. You're not a part of it. And it's very hard to come back from that. What was that?
This is one of the most consistent ideas is the importance of staying in the game. Just right. Not getting knocked out of the game. You want to live to fight another day. So sorry, you were about to ask a question before I interrupted you.
Oh, I was just going to ask, I mean, meeting one of the greatest investors, not only of today, but of all time, what was that experience like? And what did you take away from Charlie Munger? Can you share that with our audience?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, in some cases with this book, I literally would spend 5 days with a person, right? So I went across India with Monish Pabrai for 5 days, and I've interviewed him many other times. Someone like Bill Miller, I've interviewed for the best part of 100 hours over the last 22 years. And when I wrote to Munger, basically I said, I'm coming to Los Angeles for the Daily Journal meeting because he was chair of the Daily Journal. And I said, you know, here are my credentials. Here's what I'm doing. Here's what I'm writing about. Here are the people I've interviewed. It would be amazing to come interview you if possible. And I get back this note that basically says, yeah, I'll spend, or it was from his assistant who says, Mr. Munger will meet you for 10 minutes before the Daily Journal meeting. And I was ecstatic. And at the same time, it's like, oh my God, 10 minutes? What am I going to do? And so I fly into Los Angeles and I arrive an hour early for the meeting. And I go and wait outside his office, outside the room, the conference room where he was having the meeting, for an hour, just on the off chance that I would get in there earlier. Then that doesn't work. And so the meeting starts on time and I go in and and people are kind of leaving the room and it's kind of noisy and distracting. And he's this little old guy, like probably 93 at the time. Now he's 99. Mm-hmm. And he's wearing these very thick bottle glasses and, you know, can barely see. You know, he's got one glass eye and one real eye that has apparently very poor sight. And he's very spindly and he's wearing this suit that's too big for him because obviously, you know, he's diminished and he's got this big wooden cane next to him. And my chair is so close to him that our knees are practically touching. And because and you know, he's kind of a fearsome character, right? By reputation. I mean, you hear that he's kind of curmudgeonly and difficult. And Francis Chiu, who's a very well-known investor, had told me a story about a friend of his who is a successful investor who once went and saw Charlie in an elevator. And he said to him, you know, Mr. Munger, you've had this enormous impact on me. You've really changed my life. And, you know, I come here especially for this meeting. And Munger just looks at him and says, so? And so I knew about this, right? And I, you know, Bill Miller had once told me that he ran into Charlie on the street in Manhattan, right near Radio City in Manhattan.
Wow.
And he said, Charlie. And Charlie turns around and says, who the hell are you? And then they ended up kind of chatting. He told him who he was and Charlie remembered who he was. And they ended up chatting for the next hour and walking around the city together. So I had this kind of trepidation of thinking, you know, here's this kind of scary guy. And then he couldn't have been more pleasant. He was like, hello, nice to meet you. You know, pull up a chair. And because I only had this short amount of time, which turned out to be more time in the end, because I spent longer with him after the Daily Journal meeting, there was a Q&A session. I got to ask him several more questions. And then since then, I've had this Zoom breakfast. But because I had only this short time, I really had to decide in advance, as I would put it, what's the eye of the bullseye? And so I spent weeks reading everything that he'd written over the years, old speeches, transcripts from previous meetings, poor Charlie's almanac, this collection of his writings. And so I was really deeply versed in what mattered most. And so this goes back to the first question where you talked about, where we discussed what I was trying to distill and synthesize and live by from each of these people. And so the conclusion I came to was the single most important lesson to learn from this great polymath that people haven't really focused on is this simple habit of trying to avoid standard stupidities, trying to reduce common errors in thinking and behavior that end up leading to disaster or disappointment, both in markets and life. And this is a kind of master principle. And so right at the start, usually in an interview, you might, you're trying to build some sort of rapport. You dance around before you get to the most important questions, maybe. On this occasion, the very first thing I said to him was, Charlie, I've come to regard you as the grand master of stupidity reduction. Why do you take that approach? And he says, well, it works. It just works. Mm-hmm. And so we start discussing the absolute meat of this topic. I started asking him where that idea came from. And he talked about this friend of his, Garrett Hardin, for example, who is an ecologist. And one of the things that Garrett Hardin, who's not alive anymore, but who is a very, very esteemed academic and a close friend of Charlie's, one of the things that Garrett Hardin used to do, according to Charlie, was he would say, if you wanted to help India, for example, how would you decide to wreck India? And so you start by asking, by inverting it and saying, okay, if my goal is to help India, how would I wreck it? What behavior would destroy it? So you start by inverting everything. And so this process of inversion comes originally from this 19th century mathematician, this algebraist, Carl Gustav Jacobi, who said, invert, always invert. And so what Charlie is doing is he's taking this idea of inversion and he's applying it in all of these areas of his life. And so when you invest, for example, you start by saying, what could make this a disaster? And so think of, so instead of focusing on reaching for the prize, as Charlie would say, you're focusing on what can go wrong. And so in a way, it's very much inspired by the teachings of people like Darwin and other scientists like Richard Feynman or Einstein, who were always seeking disconfirming evidence. And so this is an incredibly helpful technique, both in investing and life, because we tend to be, because of things like confirmation bias, we tend always to look for things that will reinforce our existing views. And so then you have Charlie saying, any year in which you fail to destroy one of your most cherished ideas or beliefs is a wasted year. Wow. And so Charlie is actually congratulating himself on destroying his most loved beliefs. And so you look at Berkshire Hathaway and you think, well, here's this company that, for example, never invested in technology. Mm-hmm. And turns out that in his late 80s, Buffett makes the most lucrative investment of his career by investing in Apple. They never believed in investing in things like railroads. They didn't really invest internationally. And then they invested in places like Israel. And so it's been this constant process of expanding their circle of competence and questioning what they believe. And so think, for example, of the investment that they made in See's Candies, which they almost rejected because they thought it was too expensive. And they would have walked away from this thing. I think even if it had been another $100,000 or something, they would have walked away from it. And they've made billions of dollars in revenues off this very inexpensive investment. And really what happened is they started to realize, okay, so we shouldn't be investing in cheap cigar butts. We should be looking for higher quality businesses. And so their whole career actually has been built on the ability to question their existing beliefs in a way that welcomes disconfirming evidence. And you look at this in other areas of Charlie's life where you think, for example, he's a Republican who's voted for Democrats. He changed his views on abortion over the years. He makes a point of reading Paul Krugman's columns in the New York Times because his politics are different than Paul Krugman's. And so he's actually welcoming things that challenge his own beliefs. And so if you think about our own lives, that's an incredibly helpful attitude to bring in, to say, you know, what do I know? Given my prejudices and my upbringing, I've inherited certain beliefs. I there are all of these, as Buddhists would say, causes and conditions that made me the way I am, made other people the way they are. And I just need to look at these things a little bit more objectively and say, well, why am I right about that when it comes to politics? Why am I right about this when it comes to economics? And so in a way, this really isn't a political comment. It's really a reminder that we need to be more aware of our own blindness, our own blind spots, our own limitations, and just tread a little bit more lightly, have a little bit more respect for other people's views. And this is very helpful, not only in politics or family relationships or whatever, or friendships, but in investing. Mm-hmm. Think of someone like Michael Steinhardt, right? Who used to do, you know, he would get the biggest bull and the biggest bear to come into a room and discuss their views of a stock. So there's something really remarkably agnostic about that. Likewise with Bill Miller, who I was chatting to a few weeks ago in New York, and he was saying the fact that Charlie and Warren, who he admires very deeply, think that Bitcoin is rat poison squared, is not a reason for him either to own Bitcoin or not, which he owns in enormous quantities. Mm-hmm. He says, I have to just assess the evidence. I have to look at the evidence. And the truth is, in his view, that that these very old white guys from Omaha don't have any domain expertise in new technology. And why should they? So he's like, well, why should I take their view as being the holy gospel on the subject of Bitcoin? So again, it's a reminder not to get so carried away by, you know, authority bias, for example, assuming, as I did, that because Charlie and Lou Simpson are brilliant and much better at investing than I am, that they're right about Alibaba. It's like, no, they don't really have any particular expertise in understanding the Chinese government and Chinese regulation and the risks therein. And so, you know, just you have to do the work for yourself, think for yourself, but really engage with people whose views are different from yours.
Wonderful. So I'm glad you brought this point, because one of the chapters I thought was very interesting, and this is something that our friend Monish Pabrai touched on when he was on our show, is he talked about the power of compounding. And it seems like over the long haul, when you look at super investors and you try to mimic some of the things they do very well, it tends to work out over the long term. But my question, Mr. Green, is if it works so well for them, why doesn't everyone do it? What is the reason, you think?
Why doesn't everyone just clone?
Clone, yes.
The best ideas. Yeah, I mean, I write at great length about cloning in the first chapter of the book. And one of the reasons for this, I'd spent a lot of time with Monish over the years. And when I decided to start writing the book, I knew very early on that this was a hugely important principle. This idea of reverse engineering the behavior and decision-making of people who are smarter and wiser and more successful than we are, and figuring out how to replicate it with fierce attention to detail. It's a very powerful principle. It's a hugely important thing to master. And so the very first thing, the two first interviews that I scheduled when I started to do the book, were I arranged to go to India with Monish to spend 5 days with him, because I wanted to see how this idea of cloning runs through every area of his life, from his investing, but also to his philanthropy, where his Dakshana Foundation, which is extraordinary, mm-hmm. is a cloned organization. The other interview that I scheduled was I scheduled to go and spend a day and a half or 2 days in Austin, Texas, with Arnold Vandenberg, who I'd interviewed many times over the phone for countless hours, and who I'm speaking to later today, just as a friend and a mentor that he's become to me. And so I knew that these two ideas and these two people were just hugely important for the book. So cloning has tremendous underestimated benefits. There are areas of life and investing where you really want to be studying the principles of people who know better. So mm-hmm. think of someone like Joel Greenblatt, for example, who has figured out certain principles that are just really profoundly important in investing. So, for example, he simplified the whole essence of investing one of the times that I was interviewing him, where he said, it all comes down to this: value a business and buy it for much less than it's worth. That's it. And then applying that is difficult, but the actual underlying principle is really important. So when you have someone like Joel Greenblatt, who's brilliant and who's a kind of code breaker, who's figured out how to play this game, what the essence of the game is, you want to take that really seriously. Mm-hmm. But there's a, and likewise with diet or with exercise or with meditation. I mean, there was a period a couple of years ago where I went to a friend of mine who's been meditating very seriously for 45 years. And I said to him, I'm not happy with my meditation progress. There's something that's misaligned here. It's not quite doing it for me. And he said to me, you might want to look into this teacher of mine, this guy Sopni Rinpoche, who I've done an episode with on my podcast, who's very extraordinary. And once I started to study this great Tibetan Buddhist master, everything kind of changed. And there are certain things that his lineage over 1,000 years has figured out. And so to go to my friend, who's a financial advisor, I mean, he's a guy who manages money, a huge amount of money for about 15 very wealthy families. So a very sophisticated guy, very smart, with an MBA from Chicago, but who's also a very serious meditator. I can shorten my process of searching for the right solution by cloning him, right? And so it's like Tony Robbins, who I became friends with over the years, once said to me, I regard myself as an intelligent search engine. So in a way, cloning is going to people who are intelligent search engines,
right,
in particular areas, and benefiting from their expertise. The trouble is, you have to clone people who actually are doing things that suit your temperament and your personality and your and your talents. And so people like Joel Greenblatt and Monish Pabrai, for example, have figured out over the years how to the rules of investing, the laws of investing, and they're very similar to the laws of investing that Buffett and Munger figured out, that Howard Marks figured out, that Francis Chu figured out. And so I need to understand those principles. But then I also need to say, well, yeah, but I'm not Monish. And Monish has a kind of mathematical brilliance. He's fiercely driven, fiercely competitive, maniacally focused, very unemotional in his approach to investing, kind of fearless, grew up with parents who went bankrupt multiple times. And so he knows what it's like to have nothing. And so he's weirdly not afraid of that. So he's not afraid of loss. So he's not that focused on the downside in certain ways. I mean, in some ways he is, but he's got a much higher risk tolerance, say, than Guy Speer, who's very close to him, has. Guy comes from a similar background as me, where we both come from Jewish families who were refugees from countries like, in his case, Germany, in my case, Ukraine, Russia, and Poland. So we fled, we lost everything. We had to rebuild. We have a deep-seated sense of fear and anxiety, I think, about going back to zero. And so for me, to clone Monish is a very difficult thing because I don't have the same temperament and I don't have the same skills. So even, for example, during the very first months of COVID, something like Seritage Growth Properties collapsed, and Monish bought 13% of the company because it was this mall operator at a time when everyone was unable to go to malls. I mean, it was a perfect contrarian bet, right? That works perfectly for me, right? I'm contrarian. I trust Monish. So I clone what he's done. But then at a certain point, Monish decides that he's not that keen on the management, that it's difficult, it's harder to execute than he thought, and he sells. And I couldn't bring myself to sell. And then the stock kind of collapsed, and then it went back up. And then I saw Monish at one point. Monish was like, "No, you'll do fine." He's like, "It's worth about 3 or 4 times more than at the moment, and you know, just hold it until they dissolve it and they sell all the properties." And then in the last couple of weeks, it's kind of been collapsing again. And I don't really know what's going on. I don't really have the interest in getting into the innards of it. I don't really understand the finance of it. I don't really care that much. Mm-hmm. And Monish isn't in it anymore. And I'm just kind of paralyzed. And so I'm just sort of sitting on it, and it's kind of diminished. And I'm like, I don't really want to look at it. And so again, because I bought it cheap and it's not that big a position, and so there was a margin of safety, I'm probably only down about 20%. It's not that painful, but it's kind of irksome. And so my effort at cloning in that case hasn't really worked because I don't have the same temperament. I don't really have the knowledge, and it's just difficult. And unless you actually have done the work independently, mm-hmm. I don't think you have the conviction so that when everything goes wrong, you'll be able to hang in there. So I think cloning is vastly underestimated and underappreciated. There's a great deal of low-hanging fruit that you can pick off by cloning in many areas of life. you do want to learn the principles of investing, the laws of investing from these people. You do want to study their habits. You do want to see what's worked in different areas of life. But you have to adapt it to your own circumstances, your own temperament, your own skills. And so it's nuanced. And, you know, as with many great truths in life, they're contradictory, right? So you have to clone because you want to learn from people who are better and smarter and wiser than you. And at the same time, you have to be true to yourself, which is totally, totally contradictory. And you know, if you look carefully at my book, the very first chapter is about the power of cloning and simply replicating other people's ideas. And the very second chapter right after this is called The Willingness to be Lonely, and is all about Sir John Templeton, who never cloned a single person and didn't even really take advice from his parents. And he's like, no, I didn't learn from anyone. I didn't want to be influenced by anyone. And so that's a totally contradictory thing. And both of them are true. And this is one of the great secrets of life, is you need to be able to understand one principle and understand that the opposite principle can also be true. And this is something I discussed with Annie Duke recently on my podcast, where she said, you know, it's absolutely right that you need to have grit and resilience, as Angela Duckworth would say in her book, Grit, that it's one of the great characteristics of all successful people is to have grit and resilience. And it's also true that you want to be able to quit when you see that you have a lousy hand. And quitting is the opposite of resilience, and quitting is also valuable. And so part of the complexity of life is that you want to master all of these principles and also be aware that the opposite is also frequently true. And it just requires a little bit of nuance and sensitivity. It's like, just as we were saying before, that it's not about avoiding risk. It's about taking intelligent risk. Because if you, as Howard once said to me, if you, at a certain point, risk avoidance becomes return avoidance. So yes, you want to keep your eye on the downside, but you also don't want to become so obsessed with the downside that you don't invest and you don't take intelligent risk. Right. And so this really requires a degree of subtlety and nuance and a willingness to question ourselves and to challenge our own opinions, and also to stick with games that we're equipped to win. And so for me to clone Malcolm Gladwell or Oliver Sacks or Atul Gawande is a very intelligent thing to do, because I actually am equipped to play that game of writing books, cloning, figuring out what Malcolm Gladwell has figured out, understanding what he does, and reverse engineering it and replicating certain aspects of it. And then I can also, because I've been writing and editing for 30 something years, I can also then adapt it to my own circumstances and my own temperament and preferences and values. For me to clone Monish, who runs an extremely concentrated portfolio, that is not a game I'm equipped to win. I don't have the technical skills. I don't have the temperament. I don't have the passion, the interest. And so all of our listeners should take cloning much, much more seriously. Mm-hmm. There's a tremendous amount of low-hanging fruit, but to do it in this nuanced way that suits their skills. Clone the right people, and also clone the right aspects of people. And so, for example, you want to clone, a friend of mine once said to me, you don't go to Charlie Munger to learn etiquette. And I actually think Charlie is a very polite, unlikable, and kind-hearted man at heart. So I don't, you know, you can actually learn about etiquette from him. But, you know, he's brusque, right? I mean, I remember once him saying at the Berkshire annual meeting, he said, if you mix turds with raisins, you still got turds. And Buffett sort of said very quickly, now you see why I do most of the talking. And so, but if you want to learn how to be rational and how to avoid standard stupidities, Munger is the man to clone. If you want to learn how to have a really balanced, decent, honorable, upstanding life while also becoming financially wealthy and independent, you want to clone Arnold Vandenberg or Tom Gaynor or Nick Sleep. And so, you know, I think part of becoming a mature adult is to look at people and see there are certain strengths that one person has that that comes along with other weaknesses. You know, maybe they're an extraordinary moneymaker, but they're unethical. Or I was talking with someone on my podcast yesterday who used to work for a famous trader, and you know, this guy had the trader had many children and no relationship with his children, but was an unbelievable moneymaker. And why do I want to clone that? But maybe I want to clone his ability to understand the role of emotion in markets, because he was a brilliant trader who understood the role of emotion. So if I want to understand how emotion distorts people's behavior when they're trying to make rational investment decisions, that's what I want. That's a guy I want to clone. So this is one thing that Arnold Vandenberg once said to me is, you know, just because someone is imperfect doesn't mean you can't learn from them, right? Like, you can learn something from any of these people, but you want to clone the right aspects of them. Sorry, it's a very long-winded answer, but I think this idea of cloning is so powerful that it would merit a book in its own right. And I did once think of just writing a book about cloning, because it's so important and it's so nuanced and complex.
That actually brings me to my next point. I think the most important thing I got from your book is the fact that it's not necessarily the success or the money that makes these folks very happy, but it was actually the relationships at the end of the day. And one of the people that we spoke about before this call is Mr. Joel Greenblatt, who was very influential in our own fund, because when we met him, he took the time out of his day not only to meet my partner and I, but also to invite us back to his hedge fund, Gotham Capital, where he had one of his senior people speak with us and, you know, tell us everything about what they do and answer all our questions. And I mean, we had the same experience with Manish Babrai and Guy Spier as well. And I'm just curious to get your thoughts on that. And, you know, if you could just share some stories with the audience, that'd be wonderful.
Yeah. I remember interviewing Ed Thorpe, for example, who, as some of our listeners will know, is probably the greatest game player in the history of investing. This is a guy who ran a hedge fund that didn't have a losing quarter in 20 years. Mm-hmm. But before that, he figured out how to win at blackjack. He was the guy who figured out how to count cards. He figured out how to beat the casino at roulette by partnering with Claude Shannon, this famous MIT genius. And they created I think it was the first wearable computer, which was the size of a cigarette packet. And he would activate it with the big toe in his shoe furtively as the rotor wheel was spinning in the casino. So he could stack the odds in his favor by figuring out, with slightly better odds than usual, which hole the ball would fall into. So he turns this game of chance into a game of skill where he had an advantage. And so I said to him, if you were trying to figure out how to play the game of life in a way that stacks the odds in your favor, what would you do? How would you play the game of life? And he says to me, well, look, who you spend your time with is probably the most important thing. And this is a really important insight. When you talk to someone in his 80s, like Ed, who's brilliant and who was married for more than 50 years to his first wife before she passed away, you want to take that sort of insight really seriously. And likewise, when I talked to Charlie Munger after the Daily Journal event, where there was this Q&A session, and I said to him, what should we learn from you and Warren about how to have a happy life? He immediately starts talking about relationships, just immediately. There wasn't really even a segue, as I remember it. And he says, you know, we've just partnered with all of these incredible people. And he said, Warren has been a marvelous partner to me, and I've been a good partner to him, which even the use of language there, understating his own part in the relationship and his own excellence in the relationship and giving full credit to his partner, was very revealing about why they've had a good relationship. And he said, look, we have a very simple strategy when it comes to relationships. And he said, if you want to have a good partner, be a good partner. And likewise, he said before, if you want to have a good spouse, deserve one. Mm-hmm. And so I've really thought about this a great deal. Like we don't have control over many things in life, right? Like there are lots of things that can happen that take us by surprise, but there, you can control your own behavior. And so if, for example, you want to have a good partnership within your hedge fund, or you want to work with people who are honest and decent and will take care of you, be a good partner to them, be a good friend. And and this is a really important insight that, like most great truths, it sounds pretty banal and platitudinous, and it's really easy to hear it and have your eyes glaze over. But as Charlie would say about investing, it's simple, not easy. And so when you hear a great truth like this, like to have a good partner, be a good partner, to have a good spouse, deserve one. What Monish would say is you want to be maniacal about it. You want to be fanatical. And so Monish said to me once, for example, when he discovered the power of cloning and he would talk to people about cloning, they would say, yeah, yeah, yeah. And then you'd see they were going to kind of dip their toes in the water and not take it seriously. And he, in his colorful, expletive-filled way, would say, you know, these morons, they don't understand. When you find a great truth like cloning or compounding or being truthful, you want to go 1,000%. And so part of Monish's skill is that when he understands these big principles, he's fanatical about it. And so this is why you want to take to heart when Charlie says, take a simple idea and take it seriously. So this simple idea of to have a good partner, be a good partner, apply that to things like friendship, right? So if you think about, say, my friendship with Guy Spier, which goes back probably 25 years, I have to show up for Guy. Like in times when he's unhappy or struggling or, you know, a stock has blown up or whatever, I have to show up for him. And sometimes I haven't done that. Sometimes I've not been a good friend because I've been so self-involved or so busy or so tied up with other things. Likewise, he's come through for me on many occasions when I've been going through difficult times. And so one of the ways that I've really tried to internalize these lessons from someone like Charlie is actually to say, how can I be a better father? How can I be a better husband? How can I be a better friend? And I'm constantly screwing up. I'm constantly, you know, doing things that I'm not proud of. But at least I have this true north of, instead of saying, how come I don't have better friends? Or, you know, how come nobody loves me? Or how come people aren't showing up for me? I have to say, well, I don't really have control over that. But let me show up for them. Let me try to be a better friend, a better husband, a better partner. And the miraculous thing that happens in my experience and in Guy's experience, and I would say in Munger and Buffett's experience, is that when you try to behave like that, you attract different people into your life. And so there is a risk of getting taken advantage of. Guy had that a few times where the more he focused on being kind to other people and generous to other people, he said, you do attract some takers. I've not found that. Like for me, maybe I'm just naive. I just find I've drawn incredible people into my life. And I don't know. I mean, I think of something like the Investors Podcast Network, which hosts my podcast, where I'd been a guest of Stig Brodersen and Preston Pearce on their podcast, and then of Stig on his own several times. And after one of the interviews that I did about my book, Stig said to me, he wrote me a really nice email in the middle of COVID saying, basically, I'd really like to spend more time with you. Would you ever consider coming to Denmark, where I live, and I would put you up in the hotel next to me, which is a really nice hotel, and we just spent a few days chatting. And I said, you know, I'm too busy at the moment. I can't really travel, you know, and it was COVID and I was launching my book and it was just too difficult. But I said, you know, I'd love to get advice from you at some point, because I really want to, I'm really thinking about setting up a podcast. And we end up talking and he said, look, I'll buy you all of the equipment just as a friend, you know, thousands of dollars of equipment. And he's like, I'm happy to help you get started in any way. And I was like, you know, maybe we could partner, maybe, you know, and you know, we ended up, just because he's such a nice guy, mm-hmm. and he's trustworthy, partnering. And it became pretty clear that, you know, when we were negotiating about how to do it and about the terms, it became pretty clear that each of us was looking out for the other one's interests. And I think that's a really, maybe it's naive, but if it's a partnership built on trust, that's a very powerful thing. And so I think this is scary for people to, you know, we're brought up thinking it's all Darwinian and we have this kind of survival instinct where it's like fight or flight. And I, you know, if I don't have sharp elbows, people are going to take advantage of me. I think you draw people into your life like Joel Greenblatt and Nick Sleep and Guy Spier and Monish Pabrai, people like that, who behave incredibly decently, the more that you behave decently. I'll give you a beautiful example of this if you'll just indulge me, because I think it's actually kind of important, because there is a kind of leap of faith here in this way of behaving. So shortly after my book came out, I guess this is April 2021, would that be? I don't know, I have a bad sense of time. So a year and a half ago, something like that. Monish was going to buy a lot of copies and was going to gift them to people. And I said to Monish, you know, I put him in touch with this really good book publicist that I was working with, and they handled bulk sales, and there were a handful of different companies that do bulk sales for books. And they send a proposal, and I look at this proposal. Monish sends their proposal that they've made, and he says, "Is this a good deal?" And I write back to him, and I'm like, "No, they're charging you more than they should. And let me look into this." And I look into it, and I'm like, "Oh, I realize what's happened is that they're trying to steer you to this company where the sales will be counted towards bestseller lists, and so they're not giving you the best deal. And if you do it through this other company, it'll be like a couple of bucks cheaper per book, or a buck cheaper per book, or something like that. And it'll actually save you like a really significant amount of money because he was buying so many books." Mm. And Monish writes back and he says, "I'll buy it through the company they want me to buy it through." And so when I was honest and I pointed out with no agenda, I just pointed out how this wasn't in his best interests. I was showing him the thing that was against my interests and in his interests. And he immediately chooses the option that's against his interests and in my interests. That's a very interesting experiment socially. And then when you see people behave like that, think of the trust that engenders. Think of now, if ever, you know, any dealing that I have with Monish in the future, I trust Monish. Any dealing that I have with Stig Brodersen, I trust Stig. Any dealing that I have with Guy Spier, I trust him because I've seen their behavior. And so think of the reputational advantage that comes from that. But then also think of the fact that it just makes them feel better about who they are. So there's a practical reward, which is that you bring extraordinary people into your life. So think of the advantage that Buffett and Munger have from having behaved decently and honorably for so many years. You know, when somebody wants to sell their business, who do they go to? If it's an amazing business, they go to Buffett and Munger. They don't go to some rapacious private equity firm that's going to rip it up, fire everyone,
right,
and sell it for scrap metal. And so there's a tremendous practical advantage to behaving honorably and decently. But there's also the fact that you can look yourself in the eye when you look at the mirror and you can smile, because you don't look at yourself and think, "I'm a tawdry sociopath, you know, who's just screwing anyone who comes in my path." I remember once having this conversation with Tom Gaynor, the CEO of Markel, and sort of saying, "You know, do you really think it's better to behave honorably? Like, you look at all of these people who behave dishonorably in the financial world and they seem to do kind of great." And he said, "No, I think it comes back to haunt them in the end. It shows up in some area of their life, whether it's their marriage or their kids or their business. It always comes unraveled in the end." But he said, "It doesn't really matter, because I still want to behave that way." And so I think this is really important, because for listeners of ours in the hedge fund business, in the investment world, there are all of these role models there for you to look at who are kind of rapacious and who are brilliant at the game of money. But as Ed Thorpe would say, they've lost the game of life because they've just chased after the wrong thing for all of these decades. And so I think you have to kind of choose your role models. And so look at the people you actually admire. Look at the people who behave honorably, like the Mungers and the Buffetts and the the Ed Thorpes and the Joel Greenblatts and the Tom Gaynors and the Nick Sleeps and the Kay Sicarias. And it's not like these people are perfect. You know, they have their moments where they behave poorly, I'm sure, just as we all do, especially when we're under stress. But part of what I'm trying to do in writing the book is to hold up these other models for how to behave, other models for how to succeed. If you want to have a truly successful, truly abundant life, I don't think you want multiple divorces. You don't want kids who hate you. You don't want to have, like, you know, an unbelievable, beautiful, flashy home, but not really have people who want to share it with you. That's right. I don't know. I had something yesterday. It was a really small moment where, I mean, I've been married for 30 years to my wife, Lauren. She's a very lovely person, really wonderful human being. And there was a moment where I saw her give a treat to our dog, and our dog behaved in some kind of ridiculous, comical dog way. And I sort of laughed, and my wife just turned to me and just smiled. And it was such a warm and lovely smile. And you just think of that, and you're like, I just sort of did a double take from it. I'm like, what an amazing thing that after 30 years, thank God, you know, I have this wife who we can exchange a moment like that, that knew, you know, she wouldn't even have registered that it had happened, where she just smiled at me lovingly and amused in this moment with our dog. And that's a really beautiful thing. And, you know, I'm not saying I've been a perfect husband or anything like that. You know, I should have been a much better wife than I've been a husband. But I'm just saying, like, when you think about what a successful and abundant life is, being now in a home with my wife where my kids have moved out because my daughter's at college and my son is living in an apartment in New York City, and actually wanting to be in the home with each other. That's a really beautiful thing. And so, you know, don't lose sight of what really matters. And so you don't want to get so caught up in the game of making money, the game of external success, that you forget these other things, like the importance of relationships, the importance of, I mean, I talked to a very successful investor yesterday who had a very difficult period in his life and lots of depression. And there was a moment where, and obviously hugely successful financially, but very difficult periods of his life. And there was a moment where he talked about his wife and he literally starts to choke up and he said, sorry, I, you know, like, it's very emotional for him because he realized what an extraordinary support his wife had been through all of these difficulties. And so if you don't have good relationships during the difficult times, you're very vulnerable because you don't have this support group of friends, colleagues, family members who wish you well. And likewise, in the good times, you really want people to celebrate with. And when they're in trouble, when they're having difficult times, you want to be there for them. And when, you know, there's this beautiful Buddhist concept of empathetic joy. When they have good times, you want to feel empathetic joy. You don't want to have a little piece of you die because you're like, I can't believe they're more successful than me. You want actually to delight in their success. And so much of a really rich and abundant life is built around relationships. And so you have to figure out, like, how am I investing in my relationships? Am I so hell-bent on success and getting ahead and impressing people and seeming like a success externally that I'm neglecting this investment in my relationships, which when I look back at the end of my life will actually be where much of the happiness lies?
That was very beautiful. I really appreciate you sharing that with us. I think that's something that not enough people think about, unfortunately, to the very end of their life. And that's certainly what you hear a lot of folks in that age group say. So thank you for sharing that with us. Mr. Green, I want to be respectful of your time because I know you're very busy and you got a very big hole to get to today. But for our viewers that want to get in touch with you and your team, how could they do so?
Sure. I'm on Twitter at WilliamGreen72. I do try to reply to people. I'm also on LinkedIn. Feel free to connect with me there. I constantly feel like I'm failing to get back in touch with people because there's a kind of blizzard of messages. But I also really like hearing from people. And, you know, I get these really lovely messages from people about how some of these ideas have affected them, or the book, or the podcast. And, you know, I do hope people will listen to the podcast. It's called The Richer, Wiser, Happier Podcast. It comes out on the We Study Billionaires feed. So sometimes it can be difficult to find. But these are deep, in-depth conversations, often 2 hours, with some of the great thinkers in investing. And there's not really a great deal in it for me. It's not like I'm sort of getting rich off doing this. It's like, it's really an attempt to share ideas with people that can help them. And so I just hope people will take the time to dig into the podcast and the book, not because I'm sort of, you know, I'm not trying to be a shill here. I actually think there are ideas here that these people have figured out. They're very profound and thoughtful. And when you come across one of these ideas and it has an impact, that when it resonates, the advice I would have really is very much related to what we were saying before about Charlie Munger saying, take a good idea and take it seriously. Mm-hmm. If you learn something by listening to a podcast episode with Arnold Vandenberg or Guy Speer or Monish, any of these things, take it seriously. I mean, there's an extraordinary moment in my conversation with Monish on the podcast where we were talking about David Hawkins, who's this author who had a huge impact on both of us. And Hawkins wrote a book called Power Versus Force. And this had a very transformative impression on, very transformative effect on Monish, because this is where he first started to decide, okay, I should just be totally truthful, 100% truthful, because truth resonates at this very high level. And so, and people can smell whether you're truthful or not. So he just decided to be totally truthful. And on the podcast, I said to him, you know, I've read a huge amount of David Hawkins' books as well, and I'm surprised that you didn't take kindness more seriously, because kindness really also is one of these kind of superpowers that he talks about in his books. And like, why not make kindness the virtue that you wanted to go big on? And Monroe sort of pauses and says, well, I think it's much harder for me to be kind than truthful. Mm. And it's an amazing insight from someone who's working really hard on himself, who's really trying to change. And you see this moment where Monish is starting to think, oh, I need to reread David Hawkins and I need to reorient myself around kindness. And Monish is a very kind person. But that's a really powerful insight. When you take that seriously and you start to say, okay, so how important is it for me to reorient my whole life around this North Star of kindness or this North Star of truthfulness? And so really, really, I think it's about taking a good idea and take it seriously. When you find one of these ideas in the book or on the podcast that helps you, go 1,000% on it. And then if you want to reach out to me and let me know how it worked, or you have a question about, you know, a resource or something, I'm always happy. We're all on the path together, all trying to figure out how to live in a way that's truly abundant, where we'll look back and we'll be like, that was a rich life. Yeah, I went through difficult times. There were struggles, there were times where I went the wrong way, but that was a rich life. And the more we can kind of help each other on that path, the better. So I'm happy to hear from people just who are a fellow travelers on that path.
Beautiful. And definitely check out the podcast, guys. Mr. Green just did a wonderful episode with Guy Speer, which was fantastic. And I believe you have one coming up with Ray Dalio. Or did that come out already?
The Ray Dalio one came out a few weeks ago, because I did that interview with Guy just after the Ray Dalio one, but before the Dalio one was released, it was easy to get confused by my conversation with him about it. But the Dalio one also, I think, is a very profoundly important episode, because you're hearing him talk about how to develop principles for yourself to live by. Mm-hmm. And he discusses it in a really granular way. And so if you have an hour and a half of listening to Dalio, one of the most successful people in the world, talking about what's worked for him in terms of meditation, developing principles, overcoming his own blind spots and weaknesses, what an incredible gift that is. And so just take this stuff seriously. These are amazing gifts. We live in this unbelievable age where people like Dalio or Howard Marks or Joel Greenblatt or Charlie Munger are sharing their insights about what's worked for them. And there's this overwhelming amount of information coming at us. But at the same time, if you can discriminate and you can actually discern what's important there, and then you really take it to heart. And so you listen to all of this stuff. You want to be a continuous learning machine, but then you need the clarity of mind to say, yeah, this is the thing I'm going to take seriously. This is the thing I'm going to apply. And so I have a meeting with a hedge fund manager in a few weeks where, you know, I do a little bit of coaching with hedge fund managers and the like. We're going to discuss how to apply Dalio's principles in his own life, like how to develop his own principles. That's the sort of thing that I love, where people are actually taking these ideas that we're discussing and then saying, okay, so how would I do this? What would I apply if I were trying to develop my own principles in the way that Dalio does? So that's somebody who's taking a good idea and taking it seriously.
That's incredibly powerful. And not only are these, you know, the greatest investors of all time, but also some of the best thinkers ever. So yeah, guys got to definitely check it out. And please read the book, Richer, Wiser, Happier, if you haven't already. Mr. Green, it was such an honor meeting you today. Thank you, sir, for your time.
It's been a real pleasure. And I wish you much, much success on your journey. You guys are getting off to a very fast start, and you have the right mentors in people like Joe and Monish and Guy. So you have a huge advantage. You're starting your compounding journey early and with the right role models.
Thank you, sir. Really appreciate you saying that.
Great. Take care. Thank you so much.